Welcome to EAA's Air Venture 2010. We're in the Warbird exhibit, World War I Warbird exhibit, and we are standing next to a Fokker D-1, which was flown in here from Colorado, just north of Denver International, and it is one of multiple planes that are here from the, I'll call it the World War I Aviation Museum, for lack of a better term, that are right in the row here. With me is Andy Parks. He's with the museum. We have Mark Holliday, we have Andrew King, and Bob, don't ask his last name because it's not an easy one to say. Let's talk a little bit, first of all, Andy, about the bird itself. This bird flew back in World War I, and it's kind of, what, the pioneer of warbirds, so to speak?
Well, I think when everybody thinks about World War I, you think of Richthofen and his red triplane, and probably the best-known fighter of all wars is the red triplane here. It's one of the best designs that Anthony Fokker came up with in 1917. It flew for about 6 months on the front as a primary fighter for World War I, and you see it here today. We flew it in from Colorado from our museum at Vintage Aeroflying Museum. It's a great plane.
Nonstop, right?
Nonstop, yep, nonstop. Nonstop every 20 minutes.
This is the one that we all identify with when we watch the Charlie Brown specials, right, Andy? The Red Baron's
plane. I think Charles Schulz did a great job of promoting the history of World War I. And, of course, Snoopy fought against Red Baron in his triplane, and Snoopy flew the Sopwith Camel.
Let's talk about the reliability of this plane. She wasn't on the assembly line very long, right?
No, this design, actually, Manfred von Richthofen had been flying his Albatross and came up across the first triplanes of the war, which were Sopwith triplanes, and he was amazed by the performance that the Sopwith triplane had, climb and also its agility. So he asked that the German Air Service have a like aircraft. Without even seeing it, the top designer for Anthony Fokker, Reinhold Plotz, designed this aircraft, and it is a phenomenal airplane.
Talk about its reliability. That was the biggest problem. Wait till you hear how they found out if these things were combat ready. Go ahead, Andy.
Well, typically, typically in, for the German pilot or the Allied pilot, the way you found out about a plane is you flew it. Of course, these are all single-seat fighters, so you didn't have the opportunity to get checked out in it. You basically got in it, flew it in combat, and you either liked it or you were shot down, most likely. And the Fokker triplane had a little problem on its first flights with a design flaw that they fixed with the ailerons, and it became very, very prominent in the air service in World War I and was the chief fighter from the fall of 1917 through about April of 1918, when it was replaced by the Fokker D-7 on the far end down there that you see with low on the side.
When we talk about combat ready today, most of you are aware that they'll take an F-16, F-22, 35, take it out to Mojave or Death Valley and fly the daylights out of it and test it from every which way angle you can possibly be. How do they test them, Andy, with this type of plane?
Well,
literally,
they
in
just
combat,
literally
right?
Went into combat with it. And at that time, of course, they did fly it a little bit before they took it into combat just to get the feel of it. But in combat, especially with this plane, you could quickly take advantage of its characteristics of being unstable, which is a good fighter characteristic because it's quick on its axis. It's quick to roll, quick to loop. And if you look at the movie inside our DVD, you'll see some of this in the movie where Mark's flying the plane here. Mark's the chief pilot of this plane, and he does rolls and loops in it. Beautiful sequence in there. So it was a great aircraft. Mark?
Mark, let's talk a little bit about when I hear the word unstable, I'm going puke bag. Is that a good term or a bad term with a plane like this, unstable?
Yeah, it's fairly unstable, although it's a very nice flying airplane, but you're flying it all the time.
How is it unstable? Left turn, right turn, straight up, straight down?
Pretty much, yeah.
Puke bag. What is it like to fly this thing? I mean, if I got in it, I can see me as Snoopy. Put the scarf on and away I go. Is that where Mark goes when you do it? Are you not a kid at heart anymore?
Oh, yeah. It's a great flying airplane. It's not a cross-country type airplane. It's, like I say, I mean, you let go of a control, and it may go left, it may go right, it might go up, it might go down.
Or it might go straight.
Yeah, for a second or so.
Okay. What about, is there anything about this aircraft that you admire and say, you know what, this plane may be 93 years old, but by God, they knew what they were doing back then.
Oh, yeah. It's got very nice ailerons. I mean, it's got a decent roll rate, and it's a good short-field airplane. I mean, it'll land and take off and probably 300 or 400 feet easy.
You were a commercial airline pilot. What did you fly? And put the comparison between that aircraft and this one. Which one do you like more?
A triplane.
What did you fly before?
737.
Okay, and this one's more fun. Is that be?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Yeah.
No computers in here, right?
No.
No fly-by-wire.
No.
Take me through when you're up there and you do some of the rolls and everything. What is that like for you? Does it take a lot of movement with the stick to get the plane to maneuver, or do you have to really give it a jolt, or can you do it just a little bit and away she goes?
No, you've got to move everything fairly briskly and pretty much to the stop on the ailerons to get a good roll rate out of it. I mean, if you do it a little bit, it's not going to go around very fast at all. It's going to be kind of slow, and it could be kind of scary.
Rate of climb?
Excellent. Down here at sea level, we probably see 1,500 feet a minute easy.
And when you're out in the Rockies?
800-900 feet.
A minute. Okay, and what's your top that you can go up? 11? Can you go up to 11,000 feet?
I've had it to pretty close to 11. The airplane would probably go to 20.
Not without oxygen, you're not.
No. Probably go to 17.5.
All right, let's get Andy over here. Andrew, I'm sorry. Andrew, when people look at this particular aircraft, now you made this plane. This isn't a restored aircraft of any sort. You made this plane, right?
Well, a guy in Pennsylvania built it. They made, originally, Fokker made, I think, 320.
352, I think it was, yeah.
Something
okay.
like that. I think two of them survived the war. One of them was in a museum in Berlin during World War II, and the museum got bombed, and after the war, the Russians came in and took everything out of it, and there's no original Fokker triplanes left. Every Fokker triplane you see is a replica.
So how did we machine this aircraft? The engine and the wings and the ailerons, etc.
Well, everybody wants one because of the Red Baron thing, and so a lot of people have done research about what they were like, and there's about three or four different sets of drawings of different guys that have done research, and some of them are more accurate than others, but there's been a lot of research done, and a lot of people have built replicas of them and learned from the guys that went before them, so it's pretty easy to get plans, and it's actually, as home builds go and World War I airplanes go, this thing is probably half the work that SE-5 would be to build, because Fokker was a pretty good businessman and realized simpler, it was easier to make a profit if he built something simple. But it has a steel tube fuselage like a modern airplane, or like what kind of modern airplanes, 40s and 50s airplanes. The wood wings, they're cantilever wood wings. You see there's no brace wires, like the SE-5 is all covered up with brace wires. The ribs are all the same. So it's actually a pretty simple airplane. It's one of the easier World War I replicas to build.
Mark and I were talking before, Andy, and you tell me if they were lying and getting me a bag of bull, or if it was the honest to God truth. I said, when we were talking about the way the plane was made and so on, I said, in other words, you could go down to your local hardware store and lumber yard and probably get everything you need to make it. Is that true?
Well, I don't know if
pretty
I go
close,
to the lumber yard, you know, but any of the aircraft supply places, it's all pretty simple stuff.
How long would it take you to... Or did it take to put this bird together?
I think they figure about 3,000 man hours, I think, to build a Fokker triplane. Maybe less.
That's decent. And do you have to? What's the maintenance level like on it?
Well, this one's not too bad because it has a good old Lycoming engine in it. If you had an original rotary engine, which are almost impossible to find, you have to do a lot more maintenance on them. But the airframe itself is very rugged, and so there's very little. We replace the bungee cords for the shock absorbing and the landing gear once in a while. And
You referred to the Lycoming engine, and... In reading about this aircraft, I understand, if you can answer this one, Andrew, then pass it off to whoever, but the engine's failure rate back in 1917, especially in the summer, was incredibly high because of, heat or shortage of oil?
Well, it's kind of all relative, and the Germans had a bigger problem because they couldn't get the oil supplies that the Allies had. They were kind of surrounded by the Allies and kind of had to do with what they had. And I think they actually, at the end of the war, were using a kind of a synthetic oil, but it wasn't a very good quality. So the Germans had a lot more of a problem with the engine reliability than the Allies did.
So is that why you don't have an original, so-called original engine in here, and you got to like them?
No, the main thing is for the museum and to use these airplanes and fly them off paved airports. I mean, if you wanted to go really authentic like that SE-5, the original ones had no brakes on them, and they used a tail skid in the back to slow them down, but you have to have a grass runway then, and so you really can't go cross-country in this day and age very well, although Jack brought the SE-5 up from Oklahoma, but they had to find grass airports, you know, here and there, and it wasn't as easy as just... being able to go to any modern airport. So the three Fokkers are made to go really to any airport. They've got tail wheels that steer on them. They've got wheel brakes on them. They've all got more modern engines. I flew the Fokker D8 out from Denver, and then Bob over here flew the Fokker D7. But these particular Fokkers are made to be kind of practical in a modern environment, so that's why we have the modern engines on them. You could put to find an original rotary engine, if you could find one, it'd probably be $30,000 to buy and $10,000 to rebuild, and you have to use castor oil in it instead of regular aviation oil, and you need three people to start it, there are people out there that do it, but it's a lot less practical, so, and a lot more expensive.
You were talking about with the landing. This was obviously pre-flap era, correct?
Right, but all of them have enough drag that you never need flaps. And Bob was talking about before, when you pull the throttle back, they really come down.
Quick.
Yeah.
What is the speed on these things, by the way?
Well, cruise speed, I think we average close to 100 miles an hour coming out here from Colorado, so not too bad.
Is that with a good tailwind? Or?
No, I mean just airspeed, just kind of averaged out the various days. About 100 miles an hour airspeed is what we're doing.
Okay, all right. Andy, you got anything you want to add?
I was just going to say, for the people that are here, you know, a couple myths about the triplane and maybe the Red Baron that are kind of interesting. I grew up under my dad, and he knew a lot of the pilots that flew in World War One. In particular, a gentleman by the name of Boots LeBoutier, which commanded 209 Squadron, which Roy Brown was with, and he saw that last flight of Richthofen. And then another German pilot by the name of Max Holtzum, who was with the Germans. And one thing we know as pilots, and Andrew and Mark and everybody, we can attest to the fact that being an unstable airplane, what that means is that you can't let go of the stick and expect it to fly straight. And we know that Richthofen's triplane came down and landed. Although the pictures make it look like it had a crash landing, it was a controlled landing. The gear broke out because it was a real rough field. And what we know, too, is that had Richthofen been wounded in the air, he had a wound underneath his armpit that came out through his heart, so he was killed pretty much instantly, that if had that happened in the air, he would have more than likely let go of the stick, and the plane probably would have spun or done something erratic instead of coming down and landing. More than likely, and both Boots and Max Holtzum told me that they saw the plane land, and then Richthofen was dead. And what I believe, and having been involved in this for a long time, as a pilot, when you're flying the sticks between your legs, you cover your armpit. When you want to get out of the triplane, you grab the strut, and you pull yourselves out, which exposes your armpit. And more than likely, it was shot on the ground. So interesting, that controversy is going to go on forever, but you just got my 2 cents of it. But
German propaganda is what that is.